from deep inside your radio.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, back in London one more time, although there is no movie premiere outside today. No Tom Cruise prancing about as a rock and roller. Hey, babe. Know the feeling. Just a country that's gradually coming out of its June excursion into wintertime. I guess it was ordered to help celebrate the Queen's Diamond Jubilee. It coincided, we know that. And as the Queen's Diamond Jubilee winds up, there was yesterday one of the final events in the whole foo-foo-roo, and that's a technical term, which was the trooping of the colors. So she could pick them all out.
There's green, there's red.
Lovely event. But one of the highlights, I think maybe the highlight of the whole coverage of the Queen's Diamond Jubilee, which was done, of course, with marvelous taste and brevity, was on the BBC, a brief interview with pop singer Paloma Faith, which recalled one of the other great moments in pop music, the first interview with Michael Jackson's dad, Joe, after Michael had passed away. And Joe was asked how he was feeling, and he said, "Good, I've got a new record deal." Here is Paloma Faith.
And now joining us in St. James's Park for our tea party is the lovely Paloma Faith, everyone! Paloma, have you had a lovely Jubilee weekend?
I've had an amazing time. I got in, my album went to number 2 in the charts.
Nice. But here is what drew the most comment from critics of the coverage. This from Paloma Faith.
Well, if you've eaten too much, you could just vomit into a Jubilee tip bag.
How lovely is that?
How lovely is that? But my record went to number 2. I'm having a lovely Jubilee. Reason enough to have a monarchy. And now, ladies and gentlemen, you longtime listeners to this broadcast, both of you, may remember Dr. Ivar van Heerden. He appears in The Big Uneasy as well. Formerly of LSU, formerly head of the Hurricane Center at LSU, prominent in the leadership of the investigations into the cause of the flooding in New Orleans in 2005, fired by LSU in short order after ignoring advice from the administration not to speak publicly on the issue of the culpability of the United States Army Corps of Engineers. Well, this week, according to the Baton Rouge Advocate, which I guess still publishes daily, he's been vindicated. The top national organization of university professors in the United States, the AAUP, has voted to place LSU on academic censure for mistreatment of faculty. The censure gives LSU the dubious distinction of being the only public flagship university on the national censured list. Go Tigers! The AAUP also censured Northwestern State University in Natchitoches. I'm not even going to try to pronounce that word, that name. It's north of New Orleans. The LSU punishment focuses on the firing in 2009 of Ivar van Heerden and also the removal 2 years ago of biology professor Dominique Homberger for allegedly grading too harshly. The AAUP is a 50,000-member organization of faculty and other academics focused on ensuring academic freedom. 52 schools are now on the censure list. Outgoing LSU Chancellor Michael Martin said he can only make limited comments because Van Heerden is still suing the university. Whatever they AAUP officials do, he says, it appears they only have one side of the story, but the AAUP does what the AAUP does. Unquote, the Chancellor of LSU. The interim president of LSU, William Jenkins, was traveling. Declined comment. I prefer not to comment till I have a little more background. It's been 5 years, babe. The AAUP ruled that Van Heerden did lose his job ultimately for speaking out against the Corps of Engineers on controversial issues in, quote, a politically charged atmosphere. The atmosphere apparently charged by the fact that the Corps of Engineers is part of the federal government. Hello, welcome to the show.
My old man wore three-piece whistles. He was never home for long. Drove a bus for London Transport. He knew where he belonged. Number 18 down to Euston. Double-decker, move along. Double-decker, move along. My old man. Later on he drove a roller. Chauffeuring for foreign men. Dropped his H's on occasion. Said go blimey now and then. Did the crossword in the Standard. At the airport in the rain. At the airport in the rain. My old man wouldn't ever let his governors call him Billy, he was proud. Personal reasons make a difference. His last bus was allowed. Perhaps he had to keep his distance. Made a racket when he rowed. Made a racket when he rowed. My old man. My old man. My old man was fairly handsome. He smoked too many cigs. Lived in one room in Victoria. He was tidy in his digs. Had to have an operation when his ulcer got too big. When his ulcer got too big. My old man. Talking, relations had begun. All the while we thought about each other. All the best, mate, from your son. All the best, mate, from your son. My old man. My old man.
London, England, where police are busy trying to identify the mysterious yellow thing that was hanging in the sky much of today. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And now, news of Nice Corp. Nice people doing nice things. This from the Telegraph newspaper, not owned by Rupert Murdoch. Rupert Murdoch tried to pressure Tony Blair into bringing the Iraq war forward, starting it sooner, saying the longer we waited, the harder it got. This is from Alistair Campbell, the former director of communications under Tony Blair, writing in his memoirs. He claims Murdoch pressured the prime minister over the timing of the war and pledged the support of his newspapers if Tony got into the war nice and quickly. Campbell discloses that Murdoch made a telephone call warning about the dangers of delaying Britain's involvement. Campbell writes, both Blair and I felt it was prompted by Washington, another example of their overcrude diplomacy. Murdoch was pushing all the Republican buttons. How the longer we waited, the harder it would get. The next day, he claims Blair felt the conversation was, quote, odd, not very clever, unquote. This becomes more interesting when you realize that Murdoch had testified to the Leveson inquiry, an inquiry into started out into the phone hacking scandal. It's metastasized since then. Run by a judge, I believe the witnesses are under oath. And Murdoch testified he had never asked a prime minister for anything. Also this week, the former conservative prime minister, Sir John Major, he's a sir, told the inquiry that Murdoch had asked him, Major, to change his policy on Europe in return for the support of his newspapers. But aside from that, everything Rupert said was true. Because it's Nice Corp. Nice people doing nice things. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the godly. America's Roman Catholic bishops have no doubt had their share of what might be called bad press. The priest sex scandal, a Vatican crackdown on nuns, and the fight over contraception coverage and the healthcare thing. But on Thursday this week, the bishop said they've had enough. It's time, they said, to beef up their public relations. We need more help and sophistication in our messaging, said Cardinal Sean O'Malley of Boston, who decried the latest debacle over a bad PR over the treatment of American nuns, which involves an investigation by the Vatican. His comments followed a report to the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops from Bishop John Wester of Salt Lake City, head of the Bishops' Communications Committee. Wester says it's time for the bishops to fully embrace the 21st century array of communications tools and, quote, take a good hard look, unquote, at how well they communicate their message. Cardinal Donald Wuerl of Washington, D.C. suggested the idea of hiring a spokesperson, someone, quote, who can speak for all of us, unquote. Several other bishops hailed the idea, although Cardinal Timothy Dolan of New York knows there's an ecclesial problem with that idea, since all bishops have the authority to speak for the church and therefore theoretically other bishops can't speak for them. Not to mention a flack. By the way, they did not yet reach the point of debating whether the spokesperson could be a spokeswoman or a married spokesman. That'll be good debate. But the bishops at least have a new way to talk to each other. Wester announced the creation of an exclusive closed social network open only to American bishops. Should I do the jokes or should you, ladies and gentlemen? Boys' Facebook? No. Come on now. Deadline Philadelphia parents are angry that the final yearbook of a Catholic school in Philadelphia includes a photograph of a priest who is accused of molesting boys. Holy Spirit School is being closed. The 2012 yearbook was designed to be a summation of its history. But parents of the school students, this is according to the Philadelphia Daily News, they still publish that daily, hence the name. Parents of the school students say they do not want to remember David Sicily, a former pastor of the parish who was removed from the priesthood 4 years ago. One parent said she assumed the parish had made a mistake until she asked the current pastor why Sicily's photograph was in the yearbook. She said the response was, quote, well, he was a pastor, and he wasn't convicted, unquote. But it's not just the godly. Oregon's highest court has cleared the way this week for the release of thousands of pages of documents detailing accusations and investigations of sexual abuse by Boy Scout leaders around the nation from the 60s through the 80s. The files played a central role in a civil case a couple years ago over the abuse of six boys by a scout leader in Portland, Oregon, in the 1980s, ending with an $18.5 million punitive judgment against the Boy Scouts of America, the largest ever against the organization in a sex case jury trial. The perversion files, which the Boy Scout organization said were kept as a way of weeding out bad leaders and preventing abuse, became evidence in the trial. The state judge in the case ruled as evidence the files should be released to the public under open records laws, but with names redacted. The Boy Scouts, on the other hand, said in a statement, the system, the file system, the perversion file system, was kept confidential to encourage reporting of bad or questionable behavior by scout leaders, and that details of old cases coming to light years after the fact could harm innocent victims. Isn't that nice of the scouts? You know what I think their problem is? They care too much. And now, news of the Olympic movement. Produced by Jim Ebersole Jr. Well, the big news, and it is big news, in London today. The International Olympic Committee has begun an investigation into claims Olympics representatives were willing to sell thousands of tickets on the black market. The IOC's executive board met after fresh claims by the Sunday Times, owned by Rupert Murdoch, involving more than 50 countries. Allegations were included that tickets for top events were available for up to 10 times their face value. The IOC has referred the allegations to its Independent Ethics Commission. The newspaper submitted a dossier of evidence detailing claims that Olympic officials and agents have been caught selling thousands of tickets on the black market for up to 10 times their value. The IOC may also review how Olympic tickets are distributed among member countries. The Sunday Times alleges during a two-month investigation in which reporters posed as Middle East ticket touts, it found corruption involving people representing 54 separate countries. I guess that doesn't mean Europe, because they're not so separate. But they're not so... More than 1 million London 2012 tickets were distributed abroad among all the nations taking part in the Games. The IOC has strict rules to combat touts. National committees must ensure their allocation is only sold within their own region. Last month, you may recall, a senior Ukrainian Olympic official resigned after being filmed by the BBC offering tickets for cash. The IOC says it will take, quote, take on board any recommendations coming out of the inquiry to prove the way the tickets are allocated and sold internationally in the future. London's organizing committee said it will support the IOC in its investigation in any way we can. And the boom to the economy the government hoped the Games would bring to London appears to become a bust, according to the Telegraph. Tens of thousands of tourists are spurning the hiked prices, congestion, and heightened security of London at Olympics time. Bookings for July and August are down by 35% compared to last year, but other European capitals appear to be prospering from London's gloom. French ministers who lost the Olympic bid to London may be quietly rubbing their hands with glee, not only for dodging the $15 billion bill for the Olympics, but also with a 50% rise in their own tourism bookings. Barcelona and Berlin have seen their tourist numbers soar by 100% this summer. And London's bus drivers are threatening to strike, angry that they alone, among transport workers in the nation's capital, will not be receiving a bonus payment for extra work during the Olympic Games. They must not understand. The Olympics is a movement, and we all need one. Every day. Okay, keep blowing. And now, ladies and gentlemen, please give. You may want to block off the last 2 weeks of next March and join Michelle Norris, the host of NPR's All Things Considered, and other hosts of that network for the first ever Public Radio at Sea cruise. talk about sick bags. The 16-night cruise aboard the Regent Seven Seas Voyages will offer the opportunity to explore several Asian cities while rubbing shoulders with the likes of Norris, David Green, and several other NPR reporters and producers. Producers. This isn't like going to a radio station event where you hear Jim Lehrer talk for 20 minutes and then go home, says Kevin Corcoran, president of Artful Travelers, which helped organize the cruise. You're sailing with these people for 2 weeks. It creates the level of intimacy where you get to know them and understand what makes them tick. Hi, can you give me your dinner ticket? You pay for your daily paper. Of course, this is not the first cruise with an intellectual bent. PBS, National Review, and the New York Times have all partnered with cruise lines on sailings that offer world travel for wonky people. The goal of the Public Radio at Sea Cruise is to forge a stronger bond between the organization and its supporters. A few NPR journalists have been previously recruited to appear on cruises presented by others. The sailing is designed to showcase the organization's particular brand of journalism. You know, the one that didn't get the story of the run-up to the Iraq War particularly right, nor the story of the flooding of New Orleans, that particular brand. But Driveway Moments at Sea, ladies and gentlemen. It's an opportunity for fans to get to know our journalists, how they do their work, and what their experience is like, what that experience is like, says Dana Davis-Rehm, head of communications for NPR. It's in the family, the Reams. The hope is that they'll step forward and be more generous in the future. Take a cruise, make a pledge. It's the only cruise where you get a free tote bag on your way off the ship and a free mug right there at the bottom of the gangplank, won't you? And now, ladies and gentlemen,
we are proud to present Let Us Try, a ballad of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers.
Let us try to stem the tide.
Well, the Corps has stemmed another tide. The National Park Service has rejected a push for historic registry status for parts of the New Orleans levees that collapsed during 2005 August. The advocacy group levees.org has been trying for almost 2 years to get the sites placed on the National Register of Historic Places. They argued the flooding that resulted from the breaches was the worst civil engineering disaster in the nation's history, a characterization supported by the forensic engineering team from the University of California at Berkeley, the ILI team. But the Army Corps of Engineers was highly critical of the organization's nomination. A letter from the Park Service is critical of the nomination for various reasons, among them its reliance on a limited number of studies about the causes of the breaches. There are two major ones, as you may know if you've been listening to this broadcast, the one from UC Berkeley and the one from LSU that got Ivor Van Heerden fired. The Park Service says the nomination can be resubmitted. Levees.org says it will do so. No idea whether the Corps, which of course was responsible for the levee breaches, according to the two investigations, will object when the nomination is resubmitted. But let them try. And now, ladies and gentlemen, tales of airport security. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Jillian of the Financial Times writes, last month late one Friday night, I flew to England on American Airlines via JFK. Since I was traveling to family celebrations, I had most of my favorite clothes with me in a black wheelie bag, which I took as hand luggage, ironically, because I did not want to risk losing my belongings. According to a recent report, there are more than 200 reported thefts a day from checked luggage at JFK. Hey, it's New York, babe. Since it was late at night, the airport was half empty, so I navigated the ticket line with ease and half asleep, loaded my black bags onto the X-ray machine. But then as I went into the body scanners, I looked away. When I reemerged, my black wheelie bag had completely disappeared. Shocked, I hunted around the X-ray machine, causing consternation among the guards, and then we all dashed to the only other flight that was departing at the same time, to Qatar, to see if someone had my bag. But nobody on my flight or the Qatar flight confessed to taking it. And since the bag was scruffy with a very wobbly handle, a mix-up seemed unlikely. When it had still not reappeared after several days, I came to the sad conclusion that somebody had probably stolen it along with my favorite dresses. But I asked, why not just scan all those cameras to see who picked it up? That, it turned out, was impossible. Though the closed-circuit cameras had filmed me as I placed my bag on the X-ray belt, there was no camera coverage on the exit side of the machine, according to the detective Raymond Delena, who was covering the case. Apparently, the Port Authority films the entry, but not the exits to the X-ray machines. This points to a bigger question, namely whether this surveillance spending is lulling us into a false sense of security. Little wonder that TSA says while thefts from X-ray lines are not common, they occur usually because people whip things out of bags, such as wallets. But so much data is secret, so there's no way of knowing whether the surveillance is effective. There is no public information on whether the bizarre practice of filming only half an X-ray machine is widespread or whether I was just unlucky. My own particular story has a happy ending. A week after my bag first vanished, it reappeared in the hands of a delightfully friendly American Airlines employee in Dallas, seemingly with its contents intact. But the mystery of why it vanished in the first place will never be resolved without closed-circuit camera coverage. And then Joe writes, Dear Harry, I'm a regular air traveler almost once every other month. Apparently, I'm on a list somewhere in Washington because every time I fly, I'm selected for special screening. The TSA agents always tell me it's the airline's decision who gets screened. But no matter who I'm flying with or where I'm flying, I always get selected for special screening. The problem is that most TSA agents don't seem overly familiar with the program. On every boarding pass, I have four S's that identify me as being selected, but the local TSA agents often don't really know what to do. They regularly miss the S's and wade me through security, forcing me to point out I've been selected. If I show up at the gate, of course, without a TSA stamp, they won't let me board. In addition, they sometimes forget to stamp my boarding pass, even if I've been screened, causing unlimited problems at the gate. Or stamp both my passes, or stamp only one pass, depending on who's on duty. They can also never seem to decide if I'm allowed to skip the scanning machine. The agents are always nice and good-natured about it all, but they seem totally unconcerned when I pointed out I could have slipped through. And the TSA's inability to figure out the system and train their agents is incredible. Jackie writes, Last Monday, I was traveling from Albany, New York, to the beach in Georgia to meet some girlfriends for the holiday. I was really dressed up with a new hairdo in anticipation of our night out together. I took off my shoes, sweater, and removed all liquids in preparation for my TSA encounter. After I'd passed through the machine where you hold up your hands and spread your feet, I was told I needed a pat-down and a full search of my hair. I suggested it was probably my fancy earrings that had set off the machine, and could I take them off and go through again? I was told no. I objected. The supervisor was called over and said, You have to be pat down. If you want, she'll change your gloves. I forgot to mention I was the only black person in the visible area who wasn't cleaning the airport floors. Security proceeded to destroy my hairdo, leaving me feeling violated by it, by the search, and humiliated for being singled out because I have kinky hair. This is the TSA working in the Albany, New York airport. 11 a.m. Monday, the 21st of May. And Jamie writes, Just thought I'd let you know as I was checking into my flight at Eureka, California Airport, I realized, much to my dismay, I'd misplaced my ID. No problem, though. They let me on the plane with my Costco card. Tales of Airport Security, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
Ever plan to motor west? Drive my way, take the highway, that's the best. Get your kicks on Route 66. Lines from Chicago to LA. More than 2,000 miles on the way. Get your kicks on Route 66. Said it rolls through St. Louis, top of Missouri. Home city looks mighty pretty. See, I'm real on gather New Mexico, Flagstaff, Arizona, Dover, Governor, King, Nebraska, San Bernardino. Why don't you get up to this timely tune? When you make that California tune, get your kicks on Route 66. Missouri, Oklahoma City looks mighty pretty. See Amarillo, Gallup, New Mexico, Flagstaff, Arizona, don't forget Winona, King, Nebraska, San Bernardino. Won't you get up to this timely tip? When you make that California trip, get your kicks on Route 66. Get your kicks on Route 66. Get your kicks on Route 66.
Likes hits, and Hollywood likes to have more hits.
So will an upcoming probable blockbuster spawn imitations? Does a bear have lips?
Got to be Inside Extra Access tonight for late June 2012. Hi, everyone. I'm Mike DeVere.
And I'm Pat Mungo. Back on my meds.
Next Friday is the long-awaited premiere date of the long-awaited premiere of the long-awaited movie Abraham Lincoln Vampire Killer. And then, the long-awaiting is over.
But Hollywood's never not been in a hurry to capitalize on a success, even one that hasn't happened yet. That's why all over Tinseltown, producers are readying action films built around former U.S. presidents.
So today, we're taking an IEAT close-up look at some of those projects.
Franklin D. Roosevelt has always fascinated me. Four terms, polio, kind of a non-fashion icon.
Kip Koppelman is head of development for Predictable Pictures.
So I asked myself, if Lincoln could be a vampire hunter, what could Roosevelt be? I mean, he's still controversial. I have some conservative friends, even in Hollywood. So I was looking for something hot and edgy and sexy, you know, like everything else. And then it hit me one day when I was getting colonic. Zombies. I mean, the first hit I got off it was this amazing visual. A man in a wheelchair commanding an army of the undead. Killer, right?
That was the germ of what's grown into the raging influenza of Franklin Roosevelt Zombie Master, currently in final pre-production in Vancouver. Justin Hardesty, fresh from his starring role in the second episode of the action franchise Bite This, The Covenant, is cast in the lead as the late president and even later Zombie Master.
I was up for the role of the schoolteacher vampire in the Showtime series Blood Drive. I didn't get it. So I was really spiked when this came along because I wanted to do something, you know, less fantasy-oriented than Bite This, but something that still had a lot of great storytelling. I mean, here's Roosevelt running World War II and ending the Depression and stuff, but at night, when his aides and wife are asleep, he has this amazing second life. And, you know, it's kind of cool how you root for him almost like in spite of yourself, you know, because he's running the zombie crew and all, like late in the second act, where his zombies chase down some Nazi spies, you know. No spoilers, but, you know, I can't tell you how that turns out, but he, you know, he still ends up on the dime.
Franklin Roosevelt Zombie Master should be in pre-production shortly before filming concludes this summer.
There have been movies about John Kennedy's Navy career, movies about who or what ordered his assassination. But until Sean Silver's company, Analytic Films, came along, never has there been anything like what's about to start shooting in New Mexico. JFK, the first Ghostbuster.
You know, I'll be honest with you. Really? I was a child of the Kennedy era. I totally bought into the whole New Frontier thing. Some of the writers, Danny Zipsis and Kevin Boyson, pitched me this concept. I was a little hesitant. But I also loved John Belushi, so all they had to say to me was, it's like JFK meets Ghostbusters, and I was sold.
The movie features a cast of relative unknowns, including Will Ferrell's younger brother, Jim, starring as the ghost-busting president. But to director Audrey Tolliver, best known for the auto-racing thriller Brake Drum 3, The Relining, that's part of the fun.
Well, the real JFK, as we know, was racked with pain and all sorts of ailments, although he seemed so vibrant and vital. Our JFK, when he's not leading his gang of ghostbusters, is always in the White House doing exercises on machines that frankly weren't even invented when he was in office, so that's fun. And then his collaborators as ghostbusters include some wonderful characters, Frank Sinatra, Marilyn Monroe, and the Russian ambassador, because, as he says at one point, this is bigger than the Cold War. So, that's fun too.
And for those of us wondering if JFK's wife Jackie makes an appearance in the movie, director Audrey Tolliver has a tantalizing answer.
It's a bit of a switch, but in fact, in our story, she's one of the ghosts. And that's a lot of fun.
JFK, the first Ghostbuster, may be the last movie to qualify for the New Mexico filming tax break. And as Audrey Tolliver would say, that's big fun.
That's got to wrap it for this edition, but Inside Extra Access tonight comes rolling back tomorrow with the results of our latest IEAT poll.
We asked you who's your favorite cable news anchor, and the results will have you breaking your own news. Till then, I'm Mike DeVere.
And I'm Pat Mungo. So long from Culver City.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the atom.
Clean, safe, too cheap to meet.
He's our friend.
Save, cheap, too cheap to meet.
Addie the atom.
Clean, save, too safe to meet. Clean, save, too safe to meet.
See, I gave you an introduction right at the top.
I appreciate it.
You do?
Yeah. I'm very grateful. I'm spinning in gratitude.
Spinning in gratitude, ladies and gentlemen. Nearly 20% of evacuees might not be able to return to their homes in evacuation areas near the crippled Fuke plant even 10 years after the disaster, according to an estimate the Japanese government made available this weekend.
Home is where the atom is.
According to the estimate, 18% of the residents in 11 municipalities in the government set evacuation zones may have difficulties returning to their homes on the assumption that effects of ongoing work to dispose of radioactive materials in the communities are not taken into consideration. In the towns of Okama, where part of the nuclear plant stands, 81% of the residents may have difficulties returning home. The figure is 49% for the town of Futaba, which hosts the remaining part of the plant. Palisades Nuclear Power Plant in Covert, Michigan? Can that possibly be true? Was shut down shortly before 7 p.m. Tuesday to repair a leak in the plant's safety injection and refueling water tank, according to Entergy Corporation, which runs the plant. The tank holds up to 300,000 gallons of borated water that floods the reactor during refueling outages. It's also the source for the safety system to remove heat from the reactor when there's a loss of coolant. According to Palisades spokesman Mark Savage, the leak was first discovered several weeks ago. The Palisades Operations Department has been monitoring and analyzing tank leakage twice every day since. But this week, the tank was declared inoperable, says the release, what I would say would be inoperative. Inoperable would mean you couldn't perform surgery on it, wouldn't it?
I think you're right.
Thanks. The plant was removed from service. Savage declined to speculate as to when it will be up and running. Repair work will include, let's see, draining the tank, locating the leak, repairing the leak, refilling the tank, and returning the plant to service. In the past year, Palisades has been... That's a complete list. At least they've done that right. In the past year, Palisades has been downgraded by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which has classified it as one of the four worst-performing nuclear plants in the United States and prompted increased inspections, which apparently didn't find the leak. The operators of the troubled San Onofre nuclear plant could face an enforcement action by the NRC over a cybersecurity violation that occurred way back in 2011. The violation was reported by the plant operator, Southern California Edison, and was corrected along with a second minor deficiency, which we'll get to in a moment. The NRC letter says the violation involved a failure to develop a procedure for a cybersecurity analysis of electronic devices.
Hey, we hacked your devices. No, they didn't. You're just making that up.
I am. The minor deficiency involved failure of personnel to follow procedural guidance. No further details provided either by NRC or Edison, both citing security reasons. But the NRC says the violation was under review and was being considered for escalated enforcement action. Edison says it welcomes inspections. The NRC letter also mentions another potential violation in 2007 involving the failure of an Edison employee to report an arrest for public intoxication.
Do you have to get that?
No. I thought that was a warning from something with you.
I'm fine.
The letter says the NRC will exercise discretion regarding the intoxication and will not issue a violation. They're discreet, our NRC are. Appreciate that. This about waste storage, nuclear waste storage in Russia, from a publication called The Diplomatic Courier by Dr. Richard Rousseau. In 2011, there were over 20,000 tons of spent nuclear fuel stored in Russia. Only a tiny fraction of it is processed at special plants. Russia's stock of spent nuclear fuel accumulates in the highly populated European part of Russia. The total contains nearly 175 tons of plutonium, the most dangerous substance known to man. In fact, the current situation in Russia, in terms of radioactive wastes, writes Dr. Rousseau, is critical. The territory of the Russian Federation is home to nearly half the total amount of atomic waste in the world. Nearly 99% of nuclear waste is concentrated in companies run by Rosatom, a state-owned company. The waste contains high-level and a portion of intermediate-level waste. All current radioactive waste repositories, writes Rousseau, are almost full to capacity. The remaining storage capacity will help ensure the operation of civilian nuclear reactors only for another 5 to 8 years. Russia has no laws on how to handle radioactive waste and spent nuclear fuel. The unmonitored use of fissile materials continues to be a potential threat in Russia. The nuclear energy market is rapidly growing. This despite the fact that the cost of building a new plant at the Finnish facility is $3.9 billion, an amount possibly seven times greater than the investments needed to build a power plant that runs on fossil fuels. The safety of nuclear reactors is primarily provided through the increased number of sophisticated security systems and physical barriers. These systems make nuclear plants increasingly more complex, which drives up their construction and operation costs. Many Russian and foreign specialists are adamantly opposed to extending the designed working life of old nuclear units. They do not meet modern safety requirements. And management of the nuclear power plants operating on Russian territory follows the rules and safety standards that were applied when they were first put into service, in some cases, decades ago. So none of these nuclear plants can at present fully meet modern safety requirements. In 2002, a Russian scientist declared to the Boston Globe that Rosatom, the nuclear plant operator, is, quote, a super mafia. You like that, Adam? Addie?
Get my name right. Yeah, I think super mafia is better than regular mafia, don't you?
I guess. A product of the Stalinist era, Rosatom is an embodiment of old Cold War-style secrecy. It still maintains secret closed cities where nuclear energy is designed, built, and mass-produced. In 2005, the head of Rosatom was arrested in Switzerland after the U.S. State Department complained about the disappearance of $9 million it had earmarked for Russian nuclear security measures. He was convicted in Moscow in 2008, but managed to have the ruling overturned. Since the START Treaty was signed in 1991, the U.S. government has spent billions of dollars to upgrade nuclear security in Russia. In January 2002, a report issued by Russia's accounting chamber brought to light the disappearance of $270 million in U.S. assistance marked for cleaning up and building safe storage for Russia's radioactive waste. In the same report, tens of millions of dollars had been diverted to, quote, research projects, unquote, that remain a mystery to this day.
But that's Russia. In Russia, atoms split you.
And the Fukushima prefectural government asked a research team from Hirosaki University to stop conducting internal radiation exposure tests on residents after the outbreak of the disaster on the grounds that the tests were stirring uneasiness. This is from the Mainichi Daily News. A government official from the prefecture said the assertion couldn't be confirmed. But he commented, at the time, research was being conducted by various sources, and we received complaints that it was stirring uneasiness. The university's research team has questioned the prefecture's actions. If proper tests had been carried out, then we could have accurately evaluated the effects of the nuclear crisis, and residents would have felt more at ease, a member of the university's research team says. This involved measuring the level of radioactive iodine in the thyroid glands of folks between April 12th and 16th of last year. Iodine has a short half-life, so you have to measure it quickly, although its effects on the thyroid can last for decades. The researchers wanted to extend the number of people tested to at least over 100, but it was contacted by the local prefecture, which told them, quote, it's all right to measure environmental levels, but testing people stirs uneasiness, so we would like you to stop it.
Uneasiness is bad.
Uneasiness is bad. Clean, safe, too cheap to be uneasy. Our friend, the Atom.
1, 2, 1, 2, 3. Baby, there's a fire starting in my heart, reaching a fever pitch. It's bringing me out of the dark. Finally I can see you crystal clear. Go ahead and sell me out, I'll lay your ship bare. Scars of your love remind me of us. They keep me thinking that we almost had it all. Scars of your love, they leave me breathless. Can't help feeling we could have had it all. Rolling in the deep, you had my heart inside your hand. You know you played it to the beat. You know you played it to the beat. Story to be told. I've heard one of you. I'm gonna make your head burn. Think of me in the depths of your despair. Picking a home down there. This mine sure won't be shared. The scars of your love, they remind me of us. Keep me thinking that we almost had it all. The scars of your love, they leave me breathless. I can't help thinking we could have had it all. Rolling in the deep, you had my heart inside your hand. You know you played it to the beat.
Mm-hmm. because of your love. Leave me breathless. I think we almost had it all. The scars of your love remind me of us. They keep me thinking. The scars of your love remind me of us. Keep me thinking that we almost had it all. The scars of your love, they leave me breathless. I can't help thinking we could have had it all. Rolling in the deep, you had my heart inside your hand, and you played it to the beat. You know that you played it, yeah. You know you played it to the beat. You played it to the beat. We could be rolling. We could be rolling. We could be rolling. We could be rolling. We could be rolling deep.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
So sorry.
A supermarket in Scotland has been forced to remove a sign encouraging people to buy large amounts of alcohol following pressure from a campaign group. The Sainsbury store in Glasgow held a manager's choice sign in the alcohol aisle urging customers to buy a case of wine rather than a bottle. Pick up a case, it's easier, said the sign. Sainsbury's has apologized and removed the sign. The death certificate that was held up by Michael Chamberlain read the cause of her death was as the result of being attacked and taken by a dingo, which proved that his daughter had died after a dingo attack. Said the family could now put their daughter's spirit to rest. This fourth postmortem into Azaria Chamberlain's death was given a record of 14 serious dingo attacks on humans since 1986. Northern Territory coroner Elizabeth Morris agreed that a dingo had taken away Lindy Chamberlain's nine-week-old girl from their tent. This week, she handed down an official decree that the dingo had snatched the baby. Coroner said, "I'm satisfied the evidence is sufficiently adequate, clear, cogent, and exact." She emotionally apologized to Mrs. Chamberlain, her ex-husband Michael, and their families, asking them to accept her sincere sympathy, and that she was very sorry for their loss. Dingo did eat her baby. Sorry. The New Musical Express has publicly apologized to singer Morrissey over an article it published in 2007, which the singer claimed suggested he was racist. He sued the magazine. The NME apologized in a statement saying, "We do not believe Morrissey is a racist." The singer welcomed the verdict, saying he wanted his day in court to clear his name. He had been quoted as saying, "Although I don't have anything against people from other countries, the higher the influx into England, the more the British identity disappears." This was in 2007. He was also quoted as saying, "The gates of England are flooded. The country's been thrown away." "We wish to make clear we do not believe he is a racist. We didn't think we were saying he was, and we apologize to Morrissey if he or anyone else misunderstood our piece in that way," said the NME's statement. "We never set out to upset Morrissey, and we hope we can both get back to doing what we do best," which in Morrissey's case is singing, what is it, sharp or flat? Deadline Dublin, as envoy for Pope Benedict. No, he doesn't have envy, he has an envoy. Has apologized in person to child victims of sexual abuse by Roman Catholic priests, a gesture that highlights the Vatican's concerns over its deteriorating status in Ireland. Hire a PR guy. Senior Vatican Cardinal Mark Ouillier traveled to a remote corner of Ireland to speak with victims in a meeting which lasted 2 hours this week. And he said, "In the name of the church, I apologize once again to the victims, some of which I have met here. We have learned over the past decades how much harm and despair such abuse caused to thousands of victims." Yeah, they learned that. "We learned, too, that the response of some church authority to these crimes was often inadequate and inefficient in stopping the crimes." The head of the Irish Catholic Church last month apologized, but rejected calls to resign after a TV documentary reported he failed to warn parents their children were being sexually abused by a priest. He didn't learn that. The president of a prestigious university in Paris apologized for an exam question that said a 2009 Israeli bombing in Gaza may have been a war crime. Vincent Berger, president of Paris Diderot University, wrote a letter expressing his dismay and regret at the inclusion of the question in an exam for medical students on June 12th. The question inquired as to the classification of a bombing in a Gaza Strip, which resulted in 22 victims. Crime of war, crime against humanity, or genocide were the choices. Berger added the question contained a regrettable polemic character, which contradicts the spirit of neutrality and moderation of higher education. The question does not fit the relevant pedagogic framework, he said. The dean of the university's medical factory, Benoit Schlemmer, expressed his regret about the question in a separate letter. Paris Diderot was ranked as France's fourth best university last year. Polish TV, Poland's public broadcaster, that is, hey, get on the cruise with them, has apologized for showing the Soviet flag on one of its newscasts, giving the result of the Euro 2012 co-host match with Russia. Soccer, ladies and gentlemen, this week, the graphic of a small red flag with a hammer and sickle, not used as a national symbol for two decades, appeared on the air. Relations between the two countries still not the best. Three Chinese officials have been suspended. The government has apologized to a young mother who was forced to abort her child 7 months into the pregnancy due to China's one-child limit law. Graphic images of the mother and the lifeless body of the baby sparked a public uproar after they were posted online by a Chinese activist group. Microsoft apologized last week for a presentation to a software programmers conference in Norway that featured dancing girls and profane song lyrics after the video went viral. The presentation to the Norwegian Developers Conference was intended to promote new advances in Microsoft's cloud computing platform, but the company warmed up the crowd with dancers and house music. The song's lyrics flashed on video screens, including the words micro and soft don't apply to my penis. The audience of computer programmers were not amused and took to Twitter. Must be the same person who devised those ads that went viral on YouTube for Microsoft a couple years ago. HBO has apologized for commentary on the Game of Thrones first season DVD release, in which the executive producers note that one of several decapitated heads on sticks is that of former President George Bush. The network says it has halted future shipments of the DVD, has removed them from its digital platforms, and will edit the scene for future telecasts. The producers said, well, HBO says, we were deeply dismayed to see this and find it unacceptable, disrespectful, and in very bad taste. HBO said, ladies and gentlemen, just food for thought. The two showrunners who provided the commentary said what happened is, quote, we use a lot of prosthetic body parts on the show, heads, arms, etc. We can't afford to have these all made from scratch, so we rent them in bulk. After the scene was shot, someone pointed out one of the heads looked like George W. Bush, and we mentioned this in the commentary. We meant no disrespect to the former president and apologize if anything we said or did suggested otherwise. Hey, HBO, give them a bigger budget. They can buy custom heads. And Jamie Dimon, the outspoken chief executive of JPMorgan Chase, under scrutiny for that multi-billion-dollar trading loss at his firm, apologized for the mishap on Wednesday. The mishap, it says in the New York Times. The hearing on Wednesday featured Republican senators giving him a warm welcome. They praised J.P. Morgan and allowed him to offer criticisms of forthcoming financial rules because he doesn't want to have another mishap. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. That's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations. And it'll be just like Jamie Dimon apologizing personally to the victims of the mishap. If you'd agree to join with me then, would you? Alrighty, thank you very much. A tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Hawaii desks. And thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. This broadcast is on Twitter. Join the nearly 64,000 freaks who follow the affairs herein at The Harry Shearer. Happy Father's Day, everyone. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the Rubber Promise and the home of the homeless.